coming at you from New York City. It's the Real Deal Podcast with your host, Ian Phillips.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time you're listening to this. Welcome to the Real Deal Podcast. My name is Ian Phillips, here with a new episode for you. I'm currently missing the Mindy Project to watch this, so I put myself through a lot for what has just proved so far to just be weekly pop culture self-therapy. Therapy through pop culture, people. According to yet another news story, we are in another golden age, people. We are in the golden age of saying it is the golden age of different things. That term lately for golden age, it's mainly been thrown around for TV a lot. Nobody has said it's the golden age of movies since like the 40s. But there's a little headline from New York Magazine or from Vulture saying that we are currently living in the golden age of podcasts. Not that far off. It's a pretty amazing time for podcasts. They're mainly pointing to Serial. If you haven't listened to Serial, you should. But so Serial is a podcast that comes from This American Life, which is a storytelling podcast. But Serial is unique because it's like a TV. It's kind of like True Detective, the podcast. Every episode is just part of one big story. It's based on this murder that happened in the 90s and an investigation surrounding it. And this reporter named Sarah Koenig is going investigating everything and kind of, I think she's kind of doing it as she goes along. So we don't really know how long this season's going to take. And it's really thrilling. And I feel like it's one of the first times that a podcast has really been connecting with everybody. People who don't normally listen to podcasts, people who love podcasts. Like, you know, like WTF had reached out to like such a huge audience, but it still didn't seem like something you would go and talk to people at dinner parties, that thing that adults do. But Serial is something that people talk to about. It's really crazy, and I don't know if they're even making any money off it. I think they should be. So Serial's breaking a lot of new ground. You should listen to it. It's spelled Serial, S-E-R-I-A-L. You know, like those old like radio serials they used to do. Podcasting's really changing, and there's not a lot of money in it, and it's a really amazing time. I'm also trying to figure it out. But back to the whole golden age thing. People use that term a lot, and I think that it might be time that we stop trying to figure out what a golden age is or when it's the golden age. So mainly it's been used a lot for TV. I saw earlier this year there were multiple, like a lot of think pieces where everyone was trying to label what is the golden age of TV. I took a TV history class in college where a very esteemed professor had labeled the exact time period that he said was the golden age of TV. I need to dig that book out again and figure out what he had said it was. I don't remember. But like there's some people who say, oh, it ended when Breaking Bad ended. Some people say the golden age started with True Detective. Some people say it's all of that time. Who cares when it starts and ends? Right now, it's just a great and amazing time to be on TV, and it's going to be for a while. And that's really cool. I don't know. I think when you try and label something the golden age, you lose sight of what's really going on, and that like one year is more important than another. One show is more important than the other. True, some shows are more important than others. But like, then it's kind of like, once you're at the golden age, like, where do you go from there? What happens next once you've reached the golden age? And it's not like history where there's a silver age and a bronze age and a paleo age. Nobody's ever like, oh, we were in the bronze age of TV. When the hell was the bronze age? That sounded like I said LeBron's age. It's the LeBron's age. It's always LeBron James's age for the Cleveland LeBrons. But like, there's a lot of people, like I said before, who would say that like the golden age of movies is the 40s. By the way, no, it's not. 40s, of course, had amazing stuff, but like, I will still argue with people about Citizen Kane, that while it probably is the best movie of all time, I'm not going to just choose to watch it on any day. That movie was made for academic scholars, and anybody should just watch it once and know how influential it was. But I will watch Goodfellas over that any day. Also, the best movie of the 1940s, if not Casablanca, then probably The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Yeah, we could fight on that. We can do that another time. Real golden age? I mean, everybody keeps saying that there is no, we are not in a golden age of movies. We are in a dark age. It's the dark ages. And if you really think that, then you have not looked at your local listing or been to a theater in a really long time, because studios love to pack all the best movies into like a month period. So in September, we're just all stuck watching Tusk. Jesus, we're just stuck watching Tusk and whatever is on demand. But these past few weeks have given us Nightcrawler and Whiplash and Birdman and Gone Girl. Interstellar's coming out. There's a new Jean-Luc Godard movie. I don't know if I'm going to see it or if I ever will see it, but it's like, think of it, it's just like there's a movie by an 80-year-old still survivor of the French New Wave. Godard's still alive. I didn't even know he was still alive, but he's still alive. Like, I just think saying something is the golden age is implying that it's over after that. Like, are you saying that the time from, like, Mad Men through Breaking Bad was the golden age of TV? How do you know? You haven't even seen the next year, which brought us True Detective and Fargo and BoJack Horseman and another season of Orange is the New Black. Anybody who said the 40s or the age of movies, the golden age of movies, they didn't check out the 60s or the 70s when directors and writers actually got creative control and were making stuff beyond any bounds of imagination. Everybody keeps trying to put pop culture in this little box. Don't limit ourselves so much. I wouldn't even say it's the golden age of podcasts, no matter how amazing podcasts are, because they've been great for years while going mostly undiscovered or ignored. But the point is that, I mean, it's not gonna be like Serial could be the peak. It could be the peak of podcasts. It could get worse from there. I don't know, but we don't know what could be coming. Like, Serial is the first podcast of its kind, so there are going to be other people that do it and do it better. And right now, Serial is so amazing, but who knows? Years down the road, we could look at it like Citizen Kane, and it'll feel very quaint. And we'll say to ourselves, oh, this broke new ground, we should really appreciate it, but everybody else took it and did it better. That's why I don't like The Simpsons anymore, because they started everything and broke all the ground, and then everybody tried to do the exact same things, and some people did it better, and yet it's still on the air, and it's just like this walking corpse of a once great TV show. So maybe it is good that Orson Welles peaked at Citizen Kane. Well, Touch of Evil's a little better, but that's another debate for another time with film scholars. Point is, just there will always be creative people out there, and things can always get more gold. Movies aren't dead, podcasts are going to make it into the mainstream soon, and TV's going to keep being amazing. Speaking of TV, that was a good transition, guys. Let's do a little analog this. I decided, so why don't we track the cast of Happy Endings down? So I don't know if I've had much of a chance to talk about Happy Endings on the show before, but it was one of my favorite shows of all time, and it was one of those sitcoms that got canceled way too soon. It was too smart for network TV. There's great stuff on network TV, but it was too smart. And I keep thinking that, like, that time is done where, like, shows that are too far smart for network TV get canceled. But, like, I don't, like, it needed, like, a show like that was perfect for the risque network TV model, because there is a certain show that fits the network TV mold that can be great, but also it really probably would have done better if Yahoo had just taken it right away, or Netflix, or whatever. Kind of sucks. But luckily, it seems like so far some members of Happy Endings are doing really good for themselves right now. So I figured let's see where they are now, because you can see almost all of them on TV right now. So in the past few weeks, there's Eliza Koo, who played Jane Kirkovich on Happy Endings. Just got a new show called Benched, where, perfect role for her, she plays this corporate lawyer who's about to get a huge promotion, and then her life falls apart, and she has a huge meltdown, and she ends up becoming the public defender. And that's like, this is the first half-hour I don't know if Franklin Bash the half-hour, but whatever, it's like show, feel like first show like it on USA Network, and it's really fitting as a USA show, because I feel like it's kind of, like I said, the anti-Franklin Bash. I feel like every show for USA, the commercial for it is just like some guy in a suit, like putting on sunglasses. And this show's about a woman who has that job, loses it, and is basically the lowest common denominator of her profession, having to gain it back. The new one's on tonight, actually. I'm missing it for you people. But the pilot, I liked it a lot. I laughed a few times. I get a real sense of what it's going, and it's definitely about something. And it feels like I can see a progressive story. It's not as masterful, but definitely has hints of Enlightened in it, just in the story and the possibility of redemption. It's like a lighter version. Sorry, that cough was just the Ebola. It's like a lighter version of Enlightened. Casey Wilson, who played Penny on Happy Endings. By the way, she's such a good actress. I can't wait for her to really start getting her due. I think she is now, but she really deserves it. Got fired from SNL, and she's really gotten her revenge. She had a brief but great cameo in Gone Girl. And now she's headlining a show called Marry Me, which was created by David Casp. And David Casp was actually the co-creator of Happy Endings, and him and Casey Wilson are getting married in real life, and she's converting to Judaism. Welcome to the team. But so far the show, you know, I think maybe it's like the first season of Happy Endings where I am enjoying it, but there is definitely a lot more, and I think it will utilize its potential, just not yet. It needs more time. I'm willing to give it that. Like, already in the third episode, I think I'm just starting to warm up to the characters. It has, like, it kind of feels like Happy Endings didn't get canceled, and they just kind of continued it. So it stars Casey Wilson and Ken Marino as this newly engaged couple. And, like, at first it kind of seemed like it was going to be putting itself in this box, in the premise. But, like, it's moved on since then. It's been kind of about this group of friends, and it's very enjoyable. One weird little thing that's bothering me about it that probably shouldn't bother me so much is that, pretty sure it's set in Chicago, but come on, you can tell it's L.A. Chicago, there's no sun there. Happy Endings, they made it look like Chicago. They haven't shown a single old-looking building or brownstone. Just these huge boulevards and Mexican restaurants. That's L.A. for you. Like, there's so many, it just kind of bothers me. Like, obviously everything's filmed in L.A., not everything, but a lot of things. But anyway, it bothers me, and they don't really try to hide it. Like, if you have any show that's set in the East Coast, like, there should be a few episodes where at least looks like there's snow on the ground. There's a few other shows like that. The Office, they barely hid the palm trees in the background, or the mountains. What was the other show? It's like Parks and Rec. Come on, Indiana's. It just, like, it looks like Pawnee is such a fully realized town, but, like, it just looks more like California than the Midwest to me. It's just a little thing that bothers me. The Mindy Project, at least they don't show that, like, they made it look like a New York street. And speaking of the Mindy Project, Adam Pally is on that. He started off just kind of as a bit role and is now a series regular, and he's playing like a very similar bro character, a little more polished, a little more cleanly than Max was on Happy Endings. I mean, it's not his show, but The Mindy Project, I really think that's one of my favorite things on TV right now. I don't know. I really, at first I was okay on it. It was me personally, I've warmed up to it. I haven't even seen every episode, but I love the cast, the rapid fire jokes. I really think it's the full, I need to do a separate episode about network TV shows, but I think it's my favorite show on network TV right now. And I think it might be the heir to 30 Rock, which is crazy to think, but I really think it's close, not as brilliant as 30 Rock, but it's basically on that level. Mindy Kaling's great. So we have him. He's doing well. Damon Wayans Jr., who also, he started off as a bit role. He played Brad on Happy Endings. Very memorable. He started off as a bit role on New Girl, and now he's a series regular. And New Girl is a show I really used to love, and I still watch, but, I mean, maybe I'm falling out of love with it, or, like, it's kind of, it's been a lot more on and off. There was two very strong episodes at the beginning. There was something about, I don't know what it is, like, it could have even been, like, something to me about adding, like, having Damon Wayans Jr. there, too. Like, I don't know if his character is necessary. It's great for him to be there. I just can't pinpoint. I just feel like some of the charm of very early New Girl is gone, and it feels a little stale, and maybe they peaked when they had Nick and Jess start dating. That was their golden age, so to speak. And then it just kind of has declined from there. So I don't really know. I don't know where could it go from there. I still keep watching because all the people involved in it are really smart and really funny. But I don't know. It just hasn't. Like, there's, Fox is doing really well right now with its comedy, and it's not the strongest like it once was. And then a few other main cast members of Happy Endings right now are MIA. Zachary Knighton, who played Dave, who is very underrated. It's a character who grows on you. Dave had some great moments. Apparently, Dave was in Parenthood for a bunch of episodes, and I have not caught up to that yet, so we'll see. Apparently, he was in a few episodes of It's Always Sunny as random guy. Maybe fitting. But right now, he's a bunch of stuff in post-production, so hopefully he'll get something out there soon. And then Alicia Cuthbert, Alex Kirkovich, she is so funny. I mean, I remember seeing her when I was a kid in The Girl Next Door, which takes place in my hometown, Westport, Connecticut, but Westport High School is not a real place. But, I don't know, she was so, this is such a different, and she was also in 24, like, this was such a different role for her in Happy Endings, and apparently she's filming a TV series called One Big Happy right now, and a movie called Just Before I Go, which is being directed by Courtney Cox. That'll be interesting, but I don't know, she should be making a lot more cameos, doing a lot more comedy stuff. She's funny. Hopefully we'll see the two of them soon. All right, that wraps up our little catch-up, and hopefully we'll have even more to talk about with them soon. We're going to take a quick commercial break, but don't change that dial, because when we come back, we are going to review Zach Braff's Wish I Was Here. Everybody, welcome back to the Real Deal Podcast. It's time for Real Talk, where we review a movie. This week I've decided, instead of doing a new release, that I would do something a little bit older, not that old, but a little bit older. But I hadn't seen Zach Braff's Wish I Was Here when it was in theaters, so I decided to finally watch it tonight. I haven't even done my written review yet. Maybe I will take all the pieces from what I talk about tonight and construct it into a formal review. But I heard a lot about Wish I Was Here before I saw it. Mostly not good things. Mostly terrible things. Really bad things. And I was just starting to think if it was the movie really that bad? Or is it just because people really hate Zach Braff? He's kind of like Kevin Smith, where he has a really rabid fan base, but also there are some really rabid haters, and they are just as vicious. And loving Zach Braff is like a culture war of its own. I think I want to give... I'll pretend I'm Zach Braff's manager right now. I would give him the same advice that I wanted to give Kevin Smith after I saw Tusk. Look, kid. You gotta go back to Jersey. Go back to your roots. Get out of L.A. You got too much sun in your eyes. Go back to Jersey. Go breathe in the turnpike air. Go get a slice of pizza in Newark. Go dip your toes in the Hudson River. Or go gamble in Atlantic City, whatever casinos are left. Too much Hollywood. Zach Braff's first movie was Garden State. I know this is a lot of Zach Braff preface, but it's kind of important because, I don't know, he's just a big figure, prominent public figure now. But what was I just? Yeah, his first movie, his debut feature was, he was on Scrubs. Love that show. Who didn't love that show? Then he made debut feature Garden State, which is a really big deal when it came out. It was this indie Sundance movie, huge hit. Everybody owned the soundtrack. I had the soundtrack. I listened to it every day, and I am not afraid to admit that because so many other people can relate to that. I learned about the Shins in Coldplay and all this other music from it. I think it was the first time I'd ever heard... was Nick Cave on that soundtrack, or am I thinking of something else? No, maybe not. But Thievery Corporation, really cool band. But anyway, about 10 years exactly have passed, and time has not been kind to Garden State. I think it's probably that one scene where they bond over listening to the Shins. I mean, they don't really bond. They just kind of stare at each other, and we're supposed to be convinced that they're in love. And now that's like the biggest cliche. It's the cliche that Garden State started. But I mean, even that scene today, look at it, and it feels very trite. I think Garden State, like... it's basically, I feel like it's a John Hughes movie for the early 2000s. Just like how it's, I don't, and it's like, it's just weird because not a lot of movies from the 2000s seem dated, but that is the most 2000s movie I could think of, from the angst to the music and the problems in it, all of that. And I feel like with this, Zach Braff is trying to capture the time of 2014. Like, what's going on now? And it feels like he's really out of touch. And a lot of this movie was him just airing his hostilities with the internet because that's where his fans and enemies lie. And I guess his enemies are a little louder. And Zach Braff, I know he's like an ardent Redditor, which is really cool. And I guess I don't have strong feelings either way towards Zach Braff. Like, I feel like for some reason he's come off as kind of arrogant. He said some mean things about bloggers and like, why are you picking a fight with them? You're Zach Braff, who gives a crap? But, there's just multiple scenes in this movie where it just kind of felt like Zach Braff had just discovered the internet for the first time. And there's, like, multiple scenes where it would be, like, a character, like, look at this cat video on YouTube. Like, did he just discover that, like, funny cat videos on YouTube are a thing? Like, come on, YouTube's been around for a while, and it's gone well beyond just having cat videos to the point where they're making web series on YouTube that get viewed more than TV shows that are on network TV and Zach Braff's little movie. So Wish I Was Here, funded on Kickstarter for whatever reason. So Zach Braff plays a man named Aiden Bloom, who is a failed actor who's barely keeping his family afloat. His two kids are currently going to the Jewish day school, or yeshiva, that's what I call it, yeshiva. And Zach Braff is what you would, that Aiden is what you would call a secular Jew. Doesn't really believe in that, but his father, who is played by Mandy Patinkin, pays for the kid's tuition, and the tuition's running out because he is dying and has cancer. So, main story of the movie is them taking care of his father during his dying days, and Zach Braff kind of having to suddenly, he suddenly, like, shifted into the role of family man very unexpectedly and suddenly because his life is in a rut. It's about him coming out of a rut. You know, it does that thing about it doesn't really have a story to it. Not a lot of action happening. That's always fine with me. I love Richard Linklater, hell. Zach Braff is Linklater light, that's for sure. But what stories? I will say overall, just say first off, so Wish I Was Here. I understand the hatred. I'd not say it exactly deserved the vile anger that it received when it came in theaters, but the criticisms are 100% merited. This is a very flawed movie. And there are parts of it I liked. I liked many parts of it, actually. Like I said, I still have like for Zach Braff. I need to rewatch Garden State. I'm afraid that if I rewatch it, I'm gonna hate it. But I mean, there's like certain things I did like about this movie. Mandy Patinkin, it's worth watching for his performance alone. Like, there's a few key emotional scenes he has that will bring tears to your eyes. He's an incredible actor. There's a reason he's like, he is Jewish Santa Claus. He's just this great patriarchal figure. Like, every time, like, if I ever had to act in a movie with Mandy Patinkin the whole time, I would just be trying to get his approval. Like, that's just what he inspires. I feel like you look at him and you respect him. If this was a better movie, he probably would have gotten a lot of Oscar buzz for it. There's a few other good key emotional moments, but there's a lot of weaker parts. I was really hoping that this would be Kate Hudson's comeback. She plays Zach Braff's half-blonde, half-Jewish wife. So she's a half-a-shiksa. You know, this movie uses a lot of Jewish words. Just like, I think feel like Zach Braff just like got a Jewish dictionary and like was just hearing all these words the first time. And he's like, oh, kugel, that's a funny sounding word, and just put it in. Never used the word shiksa once. I heard that word a lot. I've heard it a lot growing up. But anyway, she was in that. Kate Hudson, she's a very good actress. She really deserves to have a comeback. She deserves her own reconnaissance. She was just really miscast in this. She has one great key moment with Mandy Patinkin, and luckily he is there to carry the emotional weight of that scene and barely says anything. He just does. She's given a speech about the importance of family and what she loves about her husband, and it's very well written, I will give it that. But it sounded like it did not fit her at all. She was very miscast. And they gave her a really terrible story. Her entire B storyline is about some guy who harassed her at work. And I mean, they barely focused, like, I think the interesting emotional weight of her story was that her husband's a failed actor and she's working this job in data processing, which is useless. She can't pursue her own goals or be happy. She is holding everybody up. And the whole movie is about how Zach Braff has to, like, do that now, and it's more about his struggle. What about her? Like, literally, they act like the biggest struggle in her life is that some guy was talking about how he had half a boner at work. Really, that's what causes all the trouble, is this guy at work says, oh, I had half a boner, which is like, you shouldn't talk to your coworkers like that, but like, they don't elevate it. Like, he doesn't do anything else. It's just that one scene that bothers them so much, and then it just leads to a complete dead end, and then a resolve that's like way, way too easy of a happy ending. She's a good actor. She deserves a lot more. Josh Gad, surprisingly, really good in this. He plays a blogger who is overweight, giant beard, lives in a trailer, and doesn't leave much. Starts dating a furry. I don't want to explain that. You can look it up, but don't look it up while you're at work. It's not safe for work. But anyway, that's probably how Zach Braff views every blogger in the world. I'm not personally offended by it. Like, I'm not offended by how the theater critic was a villain in Birdman. Just part of the story. It makes sense. But you know, Josh Gad played the part really well. He was funny and added some emotional depth to it. I don't know. What is the problem? There's a lot of problems of this movie. I took a lot of notes. It's like a Frankenstein monster of all these indie movies cobbled together. The first shot is just like looking through the forest, like gleaning sunlight through the trees, like Zach Braff thinks he's Terrence Malick. At another point, the song Obvious Child plays on the soundtrack. Both these films, both Obvious Child, which came out this summer, and Wish I Was Here, which came out this summer, debuted on the same day at Sundance, I'm pretty sure. That was unfortunate timing. I'm sure Zach Braff didn't steal anything from Obvious Child. Why would he? I just think there's like something really ridiculous about, like, this is kind of like, I feel like this is everything that people were making fun of Garden, that people criticize Garden State for, that I don't believe is true of Wish I Was Here, that it's every indie cliche that, I don't like, there's like all these emotions you feel like you're supposed to be feeling things more than you actually feel them. There's a few lines of dialogue that I couldn't decide if I loved or hated. There's one where Zach Braff says to his brother, "You know the worst part about hiding in a fishbowl? Everyone can see you." That's both a good and a terrible line of dialogue. I don't know why. There was like a few, I actually wrote like a few lines of dialogue down, and then I just wrote "ugh" next to it. Sorry, I just cursed. I haven't seen you in a while, emphasis on you. And I just remembered it was the scene where Zach Braff is starting to come out of his rut, and she's like, Kate Hudson just looks at him and says, "I haven't seen you in a while." And I was like, okay, stop emphasizing you, we get it. I think this is a movie that tries hard to be smart, but it thinks its audience is dumb. That's the problem. I'm going to take a second to write that down. Let's see. Tries to be smart, thinks audience is dumb. Evidently, that's how I feel every day. Hey, yo. I don't know. Everything happens a little too deliberately. Oh, yeah. The dumbest part is that Mandy Patinkin keeps a jar of all of his old contact lenses in his house because it contains everything he's ever seen. Although it's not part of the story at all, just like it's kind of there, and Zach Braff's son is like, "Why is that jar there?" And then Zach Braff just explains it to him. And just like out of nowhere, you did not need that at all. His daughter shaves. There's one point where his daughter shaves her hair off, and like everyone treats it like it's the worst thing in the world. Like she like had just got some life altering surgery, or she got cancer, and it's like, why can't she shave this whole? I feel like one of the things that Braff was trying for us to get out of this movie was that like everybody should be kind of unique and do their own thing as long as it matters to you. But it feels really mean-spirited. Like, it feels too mean-spirited to be inclusive. And that's what a great indie movie should be. That's also the spirit of, you know, the internet that he clearly knows nothing about. Even Zach Braff feels miscast in his own movie. You know who would have been great in this role? Sam Rockwell. I don't know. He's just great at playing, I don't know, somebody who's scruffy and like doesn't seem like they have their life together, but like you always want to be around them. Braff's Aiden Bloom didn't have his life together, but also I didn't know if I wanted to be around him. And oh yeah, talk about swearing. There's a major part of the plot involves a swear jar. People still use swear jars. I might be wrong. I didn't grow up with one. It was just kind of freewheeling with the F words in my household, but like, did anyone grow up with a swear jar? I feel like that's something that's been around since the 50s. But anyway, they have a swear jar. But also, like, there's just random points where they're talking, and Zach Braff will just drop an F bomb here and then do it two or three times per sentence, and it sounds terrible. Like, he's just not, maybe just he doesn't, like, sound as good at cursing as Samuel Jackson does. Nobody does. But, like, sometimes when swearing is done well, it's organic, it fits the character, and it can even make the dialogue sound poetic. When Tarantino puts a lot of F-words in, it sounds awesome. When Zach Braff does it, it feels like that old cliche that it's, like, kind of lazy to swear. Even though it's fun, it can be lazy. It felt very lazy when they just would be dropping the F-bombs here and there. Also, in, like, the first 10 minutes, Zach Braff already establishes that he hates this really cute dog. So, like, come on, how are we supposed to like him? Now, let's talk a little bit about Judaism, which is a big theme in this movie. Kids go to yeshiva. A lot of this movie is him, Zach Braff, kind of, like, seeking answers out. This is probably the most interesting part of the movie, the part I kind of thought was interesting, like, him trying to figure out, like, he's kind of given up his faith, but he still wants to believe in God and hasn't explored it. So he consults rabbis and goes to temple. I could see why this movie didn't do well, because if you're not Jewish, you're just going to want to tune out during all those scenes. I appreciate them because I recognized prayers and words, and those are, like, events I'd experience. I was like, hey, look, a yarmulke. Also, is the wise rabbi, like, it's not used that often, but it feels like it's kind of, like, a trope. Like, every time somebody's a rabbi, they have to have all the answers. This movie was basically a really dumbed-down version of A Serious Man. What I loved about A Serious Man is, like, they had that whole thing about the wise, like, the trope of the wise rabbi, the sage, who had to go to me to have all the answers. In that movie, he goes to three different rabbis, and none of them have the answers. He gets one guy who talks about a parking lot, another guy who actually gives him the most helpful piece of advice and just says that sometimes you just gotta roll with things and you can't answer everything, and then the third rabbi who just grunts at him, and there's basically an imitation character of Rabbi Marshak in this movie. But then he goes and talks, Zach Braff talks to a rabbi in one scene, and the rabbi gives him an answer saying that the God you're looking for might not be the Jewish God, might not have anything to do with being kosher. So he gives a very abstract and interesting answer, but it still feels too concrete. Like, I feel like this could have been a much more interesting movie, and I wish Zach Braff had stuck to that contemplative side and gone further with it instead of, I don't know, the Comic-Con thing. Kate Hudson did not need to have that sexual harassment plotline. I could not emphasize enough how much did not need to exist. She could have tried to rediscover her faith or herself. And what was the lesson in that, by the way? He ends up getting in a fight with the guy who harassed her at work, so the key is she needed her husband to save her? That's not good. So overall, yeah, let me think about anything about the Jewish stuff. There's a lot. It's good. It's always good. I guess I immediately felt like, should I like this just to support my people? My people are everywhere in Hollywood, but I wish Zach Braff had done it better. I know he's a very loyal Jew. And maybe he should have just left it to the Coen brothers. So overall, you know, there are some good parts to this movie. But any movie that ends with the metaphor of somebody conquering their fears by jumping into a pool, an event that had not been built up to at all, you know that this is just, like, a lot of cliches. You could see it for free if you want, but if you want to see something better, go see A Serious Man. Seriously. And that's my thoughts on Wish I Was Here. We'll be right back. We're back, everybody. That wraps up our show. Thank you so much for everybody who's listening. I had fun recording this in my childhood bedroom alone at 11:15 on a Tuesday night. Everybody who was listening, all three or four of you or whatever, I appreciate it. I know it's been just me alone a lot, but I will say, good news. So next week, I think we have an exciting show coming up. Interstellar is coming out, and I think we have a few fun surprise guests to come talk about it. One of them is somebody who was once on an episode of the show that never made it to air and might never make it, and we'll explain it. And then another guest who's never been on before, and I'm really excited to watch that because we'll get to have guests on. It'll be fun to have more than one voice. And we get to talk about Christopher Nolan. Nolan, even when he's not good, Dark Knight Rises, it's just awesome to talk about Nolan and be alive in the same time as Christopher Nolan. That wraps up the show. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep it real. Keep it real. Just keep it real. Okay, cut that out, Nick. I accidentally played iTunes music instead of... That was high. That suddenly started playing. Don't play that part.